seminar, and our today's speaker is Jiří Podolský, and he's going to talk about geometries of any dimension without this and shear.
Okay, so thank you very much. First, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and introducing. Secondly, I would like to apologize because I arrived from Europe tonight and I still have not yet fully accommodated to your space and time, local space and local time. But I will do my best, so please stop me at any time and things will become crazy or not understandable at all or whatever. So I've prepared a seminar which I would like to sort of make a short summary of what we have done in the recent few years in collaboration with my colleagues in Prague, which is Robert Schwartz, Marcel Tajo, Martin Jovka, and partly with Pavel Kartoš and others. And there is a common theme. This is about 10 or maybe more than 10 papers which we published, but the common theme is that they study various aspects of these geometries without a priori using any field equations, just pure geometries in any dimension, D, which I will denote as D, but they have a special geometrical property. They have no twist and no shear. So that's the common topic of all the things I will now talk about. Actually, these geometries, or the history of these geometries, dates back more than 50 years ago now to classical works by Wolfgang Kund and Ivor Robinson with Andrei Trautmann. And they, at the beginning of 60s, really introduced these classes of geometries and started to study them. And since then they become really standard stuff in classical GR, four-dimensional GR. Hundreds of papers were published on various properties of these spacetimes. And they are summarized, for example, in these monographs, like Stefani's monograph, Stefani's and Krami monograph, or our monograph is Jerry Griffiths. And Kund's class of spacetimes and Robinson-Trautmann class of spacetimes has separate chapters in this book, so you can find more details about four-dimensional geometries of this type in these monographs. But our idea was to look at what happens if we go from four to high dimensions. Is there anything new or what happens? So that's basically the motivation of this, but maybe I should return to the geometrical definition of the space-time. So we assume that we have an arbitrary geometry. However, this must admit a null vector field. Null vector field, which is denoted by vector field K. And this vector field generates a null geodetic congruence. So it's a family of rays which somehow fills all the space-time. And then we can introduce these optical scalars, which somehow identify what happens with the rays. They may twist, they may shear, and they may expand. So these are the famous optical scalars, twist, shear, and expansion, which are basically defined by this contraction of this vector field K, and actually its covariant derivative, anti-symmetric on symmetric part, would give you twist and shear. So this is a definition which applies to any dimension D, not only four dimensions. So coming back, I would like to study all geometries in any dimensions which have no twist and no shear. That is, they admit such a null vector field K for which this and this combination, which is a twist and shear, vanishes. So the rays cannot rotate and they cannot be deformed. They can only expand. And this is the definition. If they do not expand, so all three optical scalars vanish, that we have Kund class of spacetimes. Whereas this Robinson-Trautmann class of spacetimes is no twist, no shear, but expanding rays. So this is the definition. So actually, I can say Kund and Robinson-Trautmann spacetimes is the same as geometries without twist and shear. So I can use both.
One question is that in four-dimensional case for type D metrics, there is a Goldberg theorem that is shear-free.
Absolutely, but if you have vacuum,
five-dimensional is not true.
Yeah. So if you have vacuum in 4D, it must necessarily be algebraically special, etc. But from the very beginning, I do not assume any field equations. I just talk about geometries,
but
and I will switch on.
Type D is excluded in some sense. Because five dimension, it's congruence, null congruence is not shear-free.
I think it's somehow related to Bianchi identities and field equations, etc. So the Goldberg-Sachs theorem applies only when you say have a vacuum or electrovacuum, etc.
Only in four dimensions.
Yes, in high dimensions, it's a much more complicated business and not yet completely solved.
Okay.
I mean, Marcello Ortaggio and Pravdas are working on it. So it's still open problem in high dimensions. And actually, it has really something to do with shear. So in high dimensions, shear has really much, it's more powerful. But this is still open, and we will
but it's
continue.
Scalar invariant, but there is a much more invariant scalar invariance in high dimensional case.
Yes, but you know, we use just these optical scalars for the definition of.
Yeah, but in some sense, you may construct different distortion in different directions. You have more room for this, so.
Yes, the optical matrix, well, but the optical matrix can be decomposed into these parts, so I think it gives a complete definition in some sense. Okay, so this is a setup. So I would like to study geometries which has null vector field, which is non-twisting, without shear, but may expand. This would be Robinson-Trautmann class, non-expanding would be Kuhn class, in any dimension, without using a priori any field equations whatsoever, just geometry. The general metric can be written in a suitable coordinate system like Z. So notice what is there. There is a coordinate U and R and some spatial coordinates. For some reason, I don't use I and J, but P and Q for spatial coordinates. You will see why later. And the coordinates U and R are really adapted to the optically privileged null vector field K. Because if you look at it, the coordinate R is nothing else than the affine parameter along the geodesics generated by K. So it's natural to go along K to have geodesics and have R as an affine parameter. That's geometrically privileged. And moreover, because this is a null vector, it is tangent to null wave surfaces U as a constant. So we have foliation of the whole spacetimes to null surfaces. And these are labeled by U is constant, like here. So we have, for example, here, for, say, Robinson-Trautmann class of spacetimes, we have a foliation of the d-dimensional spacetime into a family of null cones, future-oriented null cones. U is a constant. U is 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. So this gives us U. And R is a defined parameter along the cone, basically. So for a fixed U and R, we have something like, if it's a compact section, we have something like a circle or a sphere or a hypersphere, and this transfers x coordinates basically parameterize the point on that surface. So I want to say that these are privileged coordinates adapted to the geometry. They are not arbitrary, and therefore all calculations are more natural if performed in these coordinates. So again, remember, for future, U is basically foliation to null wave surfaces, R is an affine parameter along them, and these are transfer spatial coordinates perpendicular to U and R, basically. So that's what happens here. And here we have some matrix coefficients, GUU, GU spatial P, and PQ is a purely spatial part, and they may be arbitrary functions of all coordinates, no restrictions at all at the very beginning. Interestingly enough, at the very beginning, we can say and show that for the Kuhn class, which is non-expanding, this transfer spatial part must be independent of this affine parameter R. There is no R, just U and X. Whereas for this Robinson-Trautmann expanding class, there is a prefactor which depends on R, and it's somehow related to this expansion scalar, etc. So these are just geometrical considerations introducing suitable coordinates for this complete class of non-twisting, shear-free geometries. Now, I should say that it may be of some importance to study this general family of spacetimes because there are quite important subclasses in the Kuhn and Robinson-Trautmann family. So, probably the best known are PP waves, plane-fronted waves with parallel rays, introduced already by Brinkmann in 1925 in this metric form, even with gyrotonic of diagonal terms and non-flat spatial part. Usually, PP waves have a vanishing E, and this is just delta. So the transfer space is flat. But Brinkmann introduced the complete family of PP waves, this arbitrary Riemannian metric here and some of diagonal terms. But this definitely fits into the scheme. So when we study this general metric, we also have as a subcase PP waves. But we also have another interesting class of spacetime studied by Alan Coley and others, VSI spacetimes.
It means the high dimensional cases as well, so it's only four dimensional one.
No. Brinkmann in 25 have arbitrary dimensional spacetime, which is interesting enough. So what is that? Vanishing scalar invariant spacetime. So this is a very interesting family of spacetimes, which has a property that if you calculate scalar invariance from Riemann tensor and its covariant derivatives up to any order, you obtain always zero. So this is an interesting family of spacetimes, which may be an exact solution within any theory which has quantum corrections like quadratic terms, cubic terms, etc. So this is also quite an interesting class of spacetimes, and again, it fits into Kund class of spacetimes of this form. So again, this is somewhere hidden there. Or other subcase is this, basically the family of direct product spaces like Bertotti Robinson or Narei and or Minkowski spacetime, which are interested by itself. And as you know, for example, Bertotti Robinson is a near horizon limit of extreme black holes, for example. So it's also sometimes used. And what about the Robinson-Trautmann family? So again, you can find in the metric of Robinson-Trautmann, which is a subclass of what we do here, Minkowski class or De Sitter or anti-De-Sitter written, for example, in this form. And of course, large family of static black holes with various horizon geometries. So they can be written in this form, something like Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates of, say, Schwarzschild is hidden here, and generalization to arbitrary dimensions, that is Tangerlini, and with lambda, that is Kettler, etc., etc. So black holes are in the Robinson-Trautmann class. And we also have not only PP waves in Kund, exact gravitational waves, which are not expanding, but also expanding gravitational waves, spherical ones in some sense, in the Robinson-Trautmann family. But interestingly enough, this works only in four dimensions. There are no such spherical Robinson-Trautmann expanding gravitational waves in high dimensions, which I will show later. So this was just to show you that we have interesting subcases, which all fit into this general scheme, which I will describe here now. So basically what we did, I will not go into detail. So we started with classifying all the subfamilies based on algebraic properties of the wild tensor. That is one topic. And the point is that typically type N spacetimes are gravitational waves, or type D spacetimes are black holes, etc. So if we really classify the general geometries, we can identify what are black holes, what are gravitational waves, or their combination. So algebraic classification is useful for getting oriented in what's inside. Then we also spend some time on finding explicit exact solutions in vacuum or with cosmological constant, Maxwell field or p-form fields, pure radiation with gyrotonic matter, etc. That's one thing. In Einstein's theory, in high dimensions, or even beyond Einstein. And then study of their properties like global structure, motion of particles, etc. So this I will now describe. So let's start with the algebraic classification, which is strictly the topic of my talk now. So we have a general metric, again written here. These are transfer spatial coordinates, u and r and du, and here are metric coefficients depending arbitrarily on these coordinates. So first of all, of course, we have to calculate the wild tensor, because we need to classify the wild tensor. So of course, we spend some time on calculating by hand on paper, without using any computer algebra, connections, Riemann tensor, Ricci tensor, and then wild tensor. And that's what really lengthy. We spent several weeks, maybe months, double checking it, you know, independently, all signs, coefficients, etc. And now we are quite confident that there are no mistakes. So we calculated the wild tensor, and most importantly, the Ricci tensor. And the result is, for example, this is for Ricci, and this is for Weyl. So here we use some abbreviations, like, of course, there is something like Riemann, Ricci, and Weyl constructed from this Riemannian part of the metric only. This is this transverse spatial d minus 2 coordinates. And of course, this r and c with this upper s means spatial for the spatial part of the metric. So that's one what appears here. And we also use this two parallel lines for covariant derivatives. This is the Clusius spatial metric again. And using them, we introduce some shorthands which are useful, like this small e and capital E, P, Q, etc. Details can be found in our paper, which was published a few months ago with Robert Schwarz. So I want to say that we really calculated all these, you know, coordinate components of the curvature tensor. And concerning the Ricci tensor, actually, it is quite compact. Well, this RR component is very simple and basically gives us some optical restriction if we, for example, want to have vacuum space times. This is also quite simple. One line, two lines, etc. The most complicated one is this four lines component RUU. But what I would want to say is that whenever you meet somewhere the metric which looks like that, you need not to calculate with the Ricci tensor. Here it is, and you can find it in our work, for example. So it may save you some time. And of course, for example, if you want to look for vacuum solutions, you just equate this to zero and you try to solve it step by step, which we actually succeeded in the Robinson-Trautmann class and partly in the Kundt class explicitly, etc., etc. So this is for Ricci. But for Weyl, it's much more complicated. So if we spend more time on all coordinate components of the vial, it becomes very complicated. This is trivial, fine. This is simple. But now this needs about 10 lines and this 24 lines for this more complicated, most complicated term, vial tensor UPUQ. So U and two spatial components. So, and really to check all the coefficients and signs, it was quite a pain. But so this looks now hopeless. We want to classify the spacetimes according to the algebraic properties of the Weyl tensor. So what to do with it? But fortunately, we need to do invariant classification. And for this, we don't use coordinate components, but their projection on a frame. And then things start to miraculously simplify. So in order to do algebraic classification of the Weyl tensor, one has to project it on a suitable null frame. So what is null frame? You probably know what is null frame, or maybe you know orthonormal frames, which means we have a Cartesian unit vector perpendicular and time-like vector, which is something like u normalized velocity of an observer. But you can construct null frame, k and l, from time-like coordinate and one privileged spatial vector. So it's a time-like vector and previous spatial vector from which you can construct two null vectors, future-oriented null vectors k and l. And then, of course, this transverse one are here denoted as n. This is a very similar notation like in normal Newman-Penrose formalism known for 50 years again, but now extended to arbitrary dimension. So this is our notation. Here is how explicitly we have chosen the frame. So this is really constructed from this dr and du and dp coordinate vectors. So this is really a null frame normalized like that. Okay? And the point is that now we project all the coordinate components onto this frame and we construct the scalars. Because here we somehow this is contracted through a, b, c, and d on various combinations of these null vectors k and l and transverse vectors n. So we have a really set of scalars which are then used for algebraic classification. Again, this is the notation is chosen in such a way that it resembles and reduces to Newman-Penrose scalars psi 0, psi 1, psi 2. Of course, they are complex, so there are have real and imaginary parts, whereas we here have more real scalars. The scalars are ordered according to their boost weight. So what is boost weight? If you do a boost, which means that you rescale the null vector k by some coefficient lambda, but you have to downscale l in order to preserve this normalization. And this is really a boost. Is there a chalk or something? So suppose you have a vector k and l adapted to this u and e1. So it's a spatial vector and time-like vector. And from this, as shown here, you can easily construct as a linear combination this null future-oriented null vectors k and l. That's trivial. You know, this is a trivial combination. K is u plus e, and this is u minus e. Now, suppose you take another one, which is lambda times that. So you have a longer k, but you must have shorter L because you need to preserve the normalization. But if you do the same construction, what do you obtain? You obtain another vector U here. So this is U prime and this is E1 prime. So this is really a boost, Lorentz transformation. So the Lorentz transformation in the privileged direction A1 is nothing else than rescaling K and L in this double notation. It should work, yes, it works. So, and funny thing is, then if you order all these Weyl scalars according to this lambda multiplicator, which has to do something with boost, you will find that because there is k and k twice, so it's scaled as lambda square. Here it is LL, so it is scaled as lambda to minus 2 square. And this is invariant because there is no k and L, or k and L are here compensated, etc. So this scales as lambda square, lambda to the first power, this is scaled trivially, there is no change, lambda minus 1 and lambda minus 2. So it's ordered according to boost weights. And the key point to algebraic classification is that actually the algebraic classification, like Petrov-Penrose classification for D, boils down to having vanishing some of these scalars of a given boost. So algebraic classification is nothing else from this point of view than vanishing some of the boost order Weyl components.
I have a question here. The thing is that you take two preferable null vectors connected with your metric. But it's possible also to rotate, for example, A around K, adding something. And it may happen that after this transformation, you will find out that the first invariant vanishes. Mm-hmm. So why you know that...
But this is invariant. This K, if we want to know when K is really aligned with the Weyl tensor, it's relevant with the null rotation along it.
Yes. So you would like to have k and n principal null directions.
Absolutely.
But how do you know that they will be principal null direction of your Weyl?
That's a very interesting question. In four dimensions, there always exists exactly four vectors k, which has the property that they satisfy these conditions.
Yes.
But in high dimensions, it is not guaranteed at all.
But you can check and find out that psi zero doesn't vanish.
Exactly.
It's not a special case. But I will be more clever and find out.
But the point is that in high dimensions, this is one of the most interesting results by, I will show later the references, that in high dimensions, the geometries are such that they do not admit principal null directions at all. So to have at least one vector k which has the given property is aligned with the Weyl is really a special property.
Yes, but
whereas in 4D, it is
maybe principal null directions are two other null vectors, not k.
No. I'm talking about one of them only. I talk about k b principal null direction, which is called Weyl aligned null direction now. And of course, I can find more if I'm clever enough and if it exists.
But for example, it is not principal null vector. Doesn't guarantee that it doesn't exist a real principal null vector, which is obtained by rotation. So
all are real here. Sorry, I should probably switch something again.
If you find such a vector that sum of its place is zero, it is.
It is. Yes,
it
but
is.
If you don't,
and it remains under null rotation. It is okay. It doesn't. If you have k aligned.
Yeah.
Your choice of L and N is irrelevant. That's the point.
If you find that it's okay. But if you find that it does not mean that it's special.
Yeah.
You have to look for
absolutely. You have to be clever, and in general, it is not solved at all. So I want to show that the geometries I'm studying admits it always and even more.
Okay.
You will see later.
Okay.
So this is just a definition. And technically, it is really simple. You just take the Weyl components, which are horribly complicated, you project them on this frame, and you get the scalars. And then you see, is the scalar zero or not? And if it's not, you know that it's of that algebraic type, and if it's not, it's that type. So everything boils down to vanishing of these scalars. And that summarizes this table, basically, which says that the Weyl types and subtypes are given by vanishing of these components as they are listed here. So in general, high dimensional geometry is of type G, general, which does not admit Weyl aligned null direction K at all. It is not guaranteed in high dimensions. But if, for example, this highest order boost scalar vanishes, then it's of type 1. If psi 0 and psi 1 vanish, all of them, it's of type 2. 0, 1, and 2 vanish, then it's of type 3. Type n spacetimes, which are gravitational wave, has a frame in which only psi 4 is not vanishing, and all the rest can be, by a suitable rotation, adapted to be really zero. So type n spacetimes are such that only psi 4 is not vanishing, and all the rest can be erased in a special frame if you rotate it cleverly enough.
So I will say that if, for example, the first invariant vanishes, you can check that event, but you cannot say that it's a 1a or 1b. It may be 2, because
if both, if this and this vanishes, then this and that vanish, it's type 2. Again, I would say, in standard four-dimensional GR, we have only Petrov-Penrose types, 1, 2, 3, 4, and n. In high dimensions, there are more possibilities, and it is good to introduce these subtypes, labeled as A, B, C, D, etc., according to which the scalars of the same boost order, but different type, because there is also some irreducible component decomposition behind it, which I will not go into details now, maybe later in discussion. So you can really separate invariant subtypes, 1a and 1b, according to whether this or this vanishes. If both vanishes, this is of type 2. So again, we have several scalars of the same boost order. 1, 1, they have the same boost order. Why? There is 1k, and there are 2k's and 1l. L compensates 1k, so they are scaled to as lambda, all of them, yes? But this and this is basically separate, and you may have subtype A and B according to this vanishes or that vanishes. And if both, then you have only psi 2 and more special, and it's type 2 and more special. Again, so this is sort of a survey going back to definition by Coley, Milson, Pravdová 10 years ago, and nicely summarized in a review article in CQG 2013 by Ortaggio, Pravdová. However, we use a slightly different notation. I should warn you, they use some other notation here, but we prefer to have these psi's because they are really close to Newman-Penrose coefficients, so at least me can immediately see what is psi 0, psi 4, I get used to four-dimensional notation.
So what is, I'm trying to ask all the time, I'm sorry, it's an equation, but I'll show you a table just.
Yeah, okay.
So psi 1 t, so
psi 1
psi 1 t component in a 1a, yeah, so it depends on the choice of a. So now you have k, suppose it satisfies that it's a line, but this invariant depends on the a. And n to choose very special one, mm-hmm. and may exist another a for which it vanishes. And so you fix a somehow, and your invariants depend on two fixed values. So k is okay, so you just study it, I don't mm-hmm. know, but n is arbitrary.
L is arbitrary, but again, if I really study whether K is aligned with the wild tensor,
yes.
then the rest of the choice of the frame is irrelevant for this classification. It's really proven here. I cannot argue technically now. But this subclassification is relevant of the choice of L if you study K.
So
but of course,
and now N is
L is something.
Yeah, but
I may live in a very special space-time okay. in which also L can be also aligned, but this is called not a principal alignment type, but secondary alignment type. So basically, this is a good point, because here is something which is called type D. Typically, black holes are of type D. And then you have a special geometry in which not only psi 0 and psi 1, the highest order boost weight can be made to zero, and therefore K is double aligned. But also from top, you can rotate it in such a clever way that also psi 4 and psi 3 vanishes, so then you are left only with psi 2, and this is the only surviving component for black holes. And in that case, both K and L are doubly degenerate aligned wild directions. So that's how it works. So you can erase it from bottom and from top. And if you do from here, it's a principal alignment concerning K. And if you go from top, you have secondary alignment concerning L. So that's how it works. So there are some subtypes. You may also have something like, for example, 3 with suffix I, which would be such that all this vanish, and also psi 4. Yeah, so there are more possibilities than just here. And it is called principal and secondary alignment types. So that's the classification. But again, everything boils down to calculate these coefficients and look when they vanish or not. This gives you the types. So that's what we did. Here is the result. So that's quite compact, isn't it? You know, we started with coordinate components of the wild tensor, and that's something like 74 lines on which you write coordinate components of the wild tensor. And then you project them and combine them, and miraculously they're combined in such a way that the structure turns out to be this. So the wild scalars, 0, 1, 2, etc., are something like, you know, simple functions like p, q, or traces part of it, f. And whenever this vanishes, then we are on a given row of the table, and therefore we know what is the algebraic type and subtype. So that's quite miraculous in some sense. And the functions here, which, you know, plays a role, are something like that. It's not bad. 3 lines, 5 lines, what, well, that can be handled. So this is an explicit evaluation of the key functions which determine the algebraic types and subtypes of any non-twisting shear free geometry in any dimension without using any field equations, etc., etc. So that's basically the main result which I wanted to present here, and again you can find it in the CQG paper published 4 months ago or so. So we can immediately have some observations, so let's have a look at it. Not only psi 0 automatically always vanishes, but also this psi 1 with 3 spatial indices vanishes. Which means, if we go back, we are exactly here. This vanishes and this vanishes, and therefore it's of type 1b. So this is a new result which was not known before, that all geometries which I have just described, introduced geometrically, are necessarily always at least of type 1b. They admit an K, which is D over R, along this affine parameter null congruence, basically. So this is one aligned nine direction. So the summary is, whenever we have twist-free and shear-free geometry, then this optically privileged null vector field is always one aligned. And even more, it's not only one of type 1, but it's also of type 1b, because also this component vanishes. So it becomes type 2, if and only if the only remaining boost order 1 term vanishes. Yeah? So again, type 2, let's come back. Not only this and this vanishes, but also this. And then you are of type 2, in which K, which is D over R, is double aligned. It's really a very special direction. But we know what is psi 1 type. This is just when this blue part vanishes, and this is a simple condition. So what I claim is that these spacetimes are of type 2, and this is a double, while aligned, null direction, whenever this simple condition is valid. For example, if we are in Kundt class of spacetimes, then there is no expansion. That is, theta vanishes, so this vanishes, and this means that this off diagonometric term, second derivatives with respect to R vanish, so they must be linear enough. So all type 2 Kundt spacetimes are here. You just choose this off diagonometric components to be linear with some functions they have here. So, and then you can proceed to ask the subtypes like 2, A, B, C, D, 3, etc., etc. Do the whole classification for primary types and then also partly secondary types if you go backwards. And that's what we actually did. And I don't go into many details, but that's summarized in this table, basically. So these are the principal types for Kundt or Robinson-Trautmann geometries in any dimension. Well, simple conditions when some function vanishes. And the function simplifies to something like few lines. Because if you apply this type 2 condition, and if you put it here into this, that is further simplification. So for type 2 geometries, this is absolutely simple. You just have these conditions, where these key functions, p, q, etc., etc., can be written basically each on one line, more or less.
But type D is excluded.
Type D is possible, but you have to say what is the second aligned wild direction. We know that k is double, that's fine.
Yeah.
But Of course, there may be many other choices of L which would also do type D. So what we did is to study type D when L, which we have chosen to be exactly this and nothing else, is also well aligned.
But does it exist, type D?
There may be others, but this is difficult to study.
No, but for this it's... so if you you cannot have this both of them eigen...
eigen, yeah, but aligned.
Two of them aligned, so yeah. If you don't have this kind of... In your table, D doesn't present.
Yeah, D is this condition that we also need
you
to get
into. For the results, so you just demonstrate the next table.
Yeah, we found what are types D, ABC, but with this L, being only this L, nothing else. There may be others obtained by another rotation.
Okay, so and you show the table now.
I want to make it as brief as possible. I didn't list it here, type D.
Okay, so there is no letter D.
D would be that you basically need to erase this and this and this, and that one will be left only with this is this P, Q, C, and F. So to obtain D, you have to have this vanishing, this vanishing, this vanishing, and you are left only with this, which would be non-vanishing, otherwise it's type zero. It would be conformally flat. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So you can erase it from bottom up and keep here only type D. Zero boost order components.
But is it you have set of equations? Is it consistent or not? Maybe it's have no solutions.
It has solutions. Yeah, it has solutions.
Coming from the point of view that in the four-dimensional case, type D guarantees that you have Goldberg Sachs theorem, and all your these lines are geodesic and shear free. But in five-dimensional case, we with Dejan Stojkovic demonstrated that it's not true anymore. So for this reason,
I cannot answer. I only can say that we have presented the conditions which has to be satisfied in order this L, which is chosen here to be this, is also aligned. That's what I claim. I don't claim more. There may be subtleties.
Okay.
But there are some conditions which need to be satisfied in order not only this to be double aligned, but also this to be double aligned. So at least we have some type D's and we have examples.
You didn't check that these conditions are consistent.
No, that's even, this is really difficult because you know there are much more possibilities. And this remains for future work maybe, but at least something about D is known. Not complete solution information, but at least something. So let me now maybe go to some special results when we can see more. So let's stick to Kuhn space times when K is really multiple, double, and even more. And by the way, this metric contains all Kuhn space times which shows vacuum, all with lambda, L-line, L-Mach-P, pluriations, etc. So if you have Kuhn, you ask about Goldberg Sachs, for example. So vacuum, electrovacuum with lambda, pure radiation fits into this metric, and we have complete classification in some. Again, some work. So here is a table, and for example, here you see the conditions for type D. But you know, this is quite difficult to handle, so I cannot guarantee that it always exists, but if it's satisfied, then it reduces up to type D. So this is a summary for high-dimensional spacetimes, and in four dimensions, there is a reduction because some of the conditions are automatically satisfied. That's also important to say. For example, notice here that subtype 2C is whenever the wild tensor of the transverse Riemannian D minus two dimensional space is conformally flat. But if you are in four dimensions, the transverse space is only two dimensional, and any metric is conformally flat. So you see that there are some trivial identities which guarantee that 2B and 2C is automatically satisfied in 4D. And also, I think 3 suffix B is also automatically satisfied. So it reduces automatically because four dimensions, I would say, four dimensions are special because 4 minus 2 is 2, and two dimensional space is special because it's conformally flat. That's how it works. Anyway, so that's this table. Then this is always satisfied, as I said, BC and 3B, etc., etc. So, and you can also trace how it fits into Neumann-Penrose formalism. Because at each boost level, you have only two conditions. And this is nothing else than real and imaginary part of Psi 2, Psi C, and Psi 4. So it nicely fits and reduces to Neumann-Penrose classification, which is known in GR. Anyway, so that's, I will not go into detail, but you can discuss it. So let's come back to PP waves, VSI, and Bertotti-Robinson, etc., which I have advertised. So we classify them. So here again, the metric of PP waves, and again, explicit conditions when they are of algebraic types and subtypes. In general, and this was not known or emphasized, everybody talked about PP waves as type N gravitational waves. But they may be of type 3 or even type 2. But of course, at the expense that the transfer space is not flat. It must be, you know, the wavefront cannot be flat, but it may have some geometry, non-trivial geometry. And then it can be of type 2. Notice that if you want to have it at least of type 3, then you must erase this and that and that. But Ricci scalar vanishes, traceless Ricci tensor vanishes, and Y tensor vanishes. So it means that Ricci tensor is a tensor that must vanish, and therefore it's flat. So you must have the metric here to be delta, just flat space. So everything starts to work somehow nicely. So if you write here delta, which is like in vanishing scale invariant space times, then you are necessarily type 3 and more special. You cannot have type 2. So anyway, just a remark. And you may have type D, for example. Vanishing scale invariants must be of type 3 and more special. And diacritic space times like that are always of type D or conformally flat, but I will not go into details. So I want to say that because we have a very general result, we can specialize always to subcases and discuss them independently in more detail, etc., etc. So it's prepared for any application I use. Okay, so another part, well, I'm approaching the end of my talk, isn't it? Well, we shall see. You don't see the page, but I can find that it's something like half of it, 25. And it doesn't matter, I will stop whenever I can. I have. But I would like to say that these scalars, which really are crucial for determining, let's come back to this, for determining the algebraic types and subtypes, can really be measured on, say, gravitational wave detectors, which is quite interesting and surprising, by observing what are the tidal effects on test particles by geodesic deviation.
It's very expensive to construct. Yes,
materials. 15-dimensional LIGO would be very expensive. But as a matter of principle, I would like to emphasize that this is really observable. And that's this part of my talk, which I would like to say. So, of course, we study geodesic deviation. You know, three particles moving along this geodesic and that geodesic. And of course, we set up a frame, orthonormal and null frame, on which we project the separation. So this is nothing else than the invariant form of the equation of geodesic deviation, which couples local acceleration, spatial acceleration, to actual position of the two particles. So z, the suffix, are spatial components of a position of one particle, free particle with respect to another one. And I claim that local acceleration of these two particles is given as a linear combination of their position, and these factors are these components of the Riemann tensor, geodesic deviation.
It's time-like.
Yes. It's a time-like. You can do it also for now, but you know, time-like geodesic deviation is now. But you can decompose the Riemann tensor into Weyl and lambda and have contributions from Ricci, which is coupled to matter. If you do it, well, we did it in these papers, you know, a few years ago, we obtained this general result, which is quite interesting. And it really says that local acceleration of two nearby particles is really proportional to their actual positions. And there are some factors. And these factors are exactly the Weyl scalars, which determine the algebraic type. I should say that this is purely spatial part now. We have D minus two dimensional transfer space, and we really observe in this, you know, local Cartesian frame what is the local acceleration and motion of two nearby particles, like in LIGO. Well, one mirror and another mirror, and there is some motion. So we measure acceleration in terms of position, but it depends on what are the components of the gravitational field in which we live? So there is a privileged spatial direction with the suffix 1, and we call it longitudinal. Because of this, because we have chosen k and l to be adapted to our 4 velocity or d velocity and one of the spatial directions. So the suffix 1 is this privileged one in which k and l is living. So this is a privileged direction, and there are d minus 1 perpendicular transverse directions. So transverse and longitudinal spatial directions. So, suppose we are in a conformally flat background, like Minkowski, de Sitter, and Tidy Sitter. All while scalars vanish. So this drops, so we are left only with this part. But this is nicely isotropic because it's proportional to cosmological constant, and the acceleration are isotropically, if lambda is positive, they accelerate away. If there is an entire Sitter space, they are attracted together, but it makes sense. So I want to say that the cosmological constant, which is the only survival for conformational spacetimes, is observed as a nice complete isotropic motion of a sphere of test particles in any dimension. So it will be just expanding or contracting. If we have type D components, which has this zero boost order, psi 2 component, like in Schwarzschild, for example. So we have typical Coulomb-like deformations. Yeah. Expansion in one longitudinal direction and contraction in isotropic contraction in perpendicular space. Like if I fall into Schwarzschild black hole, I will be stretched and I will be squeezed. So that's exactly this observation, that there is plus and there is minus. So Coulomb-like, Newton-like component, typical for type D spacetimes, coupled to psi 2, is observed here. If we have type 3, we observe some longitudinal deformations. And interestingly enough, if we have type N spacetimes, this highly special, algebraically special spacetimes like PP waves, etc., then there is nothing else than the last part, and it's only transverse. There is zero here. So you see that we have a propagation direction of the gravitational wave, which is this one, and in the transverse d minus one dimensional space, we have some transverse deformations. And they are encoded in this only surviving scale cycle. This is a matrix which is symmetric and traceless. And this gives us various polarizations of these gravitational waves. So I want to say that there is some coupling between these blue coefficients and this, and this red one, which are the coefficients which I mentioned before for algebraic classification, because basically, it couples the geometry and local velocities of the observers. But if we restrict to geodesics, which are static, they do not move in these coordinates. They transverse, velocity is zero, then everything drops, and basically it reduces that what is observed here are exactly the coefficients determining the algebraic type. Anyway, so let's go to this psi 4. So what would be the structure of gravitational waves in high dimensions if they exist? So they would be encoded in this matrix psi 4. There will be purely transverse motion, no longitudinal motion here. And again, it comes from the structure of the construction that this matrix of scalars is symmetric and traceless. So we can calculate that there are this number of independent polarization modes, which is known from linearization theory, etc., etc. If we use the rotational degrees of freedom, we can, of course, come to the Cartesian frame in which this matrix is diagonalized. So basically it boils down to the diagonal matrix with some eigenvalues here. However, with the constraint that trace must be zero because it's a traceless matrix. So I claim, and it's not completely new and not surprising, that exact gravitational waves in any dimension would be decoded after all into eigenvalues of this symmetric and traceless matrix. So we can now study what happens. According to the sign of the eigenvalue, if it's positive or negative or zero, you can solve this equation trivially, and it gives you hyperbolic expansion or contraction or zero. So you basically have this typical motion, particles recede or approach, and there is no influence, according to whether the eigenvalue of the matrix is positive, negative, or zero. And basically, if you have a special example, if the spacetime is five-dimensional, then of course we observe a three-dimensional space, because we subtract this u and r coordinates. So our local, so the transfer space in which we observe the motion is three-dimensional. So initially we have a sphere of test particles observed by some hyper-LIGO, and you would observe some deformation. So we may have only three possibilities, two positive eigenvalues and one negative, because the sum must be zero. And that would be such that the particles would be somehow approaching in this one direction, because negative one gives you this, and in two perpendicular directions it would be expanding. So it would be deformation into this shape. Or there may be one eigenvalue positive and two negative, and that would be elongation along an axis. And there may be another possibility when one of the eigenvalues is zero, and therefore that would be no motion in the direction towards u and backwards. And there is no other possibility, because you must have vanishing trace. So one always must be positive, one negative, and maybe some zero. So these are three possibilities. If there are gravitational waves propagating five dimensions, which I don't claim, but if they exist, you would observe something in four dimensions, and that would be peculiar. That would be different from what we expect. Because suppose you have a normal GR in these four. So of course the transfer space is only two-dimensional. And because we have only A2 and A3, but Tracy's property gives us that here, we must have exactly minus of that. Yes? And therefore, in standard textbooks, it's drawn that there is a deformation of a circle of test particles into an ellipse in such a way that the amount by which it's squeezed in that direction, it is elongated in the perpendicular direction. So that's typical. But now, suppose that there exists this gravitational wave in five dimensions. So the complete wave is described by this 3x3 matrix, which is diagonalized, and must have a vanishing trace. But we can measure only in this two-dimensional sector. We cannot see this extra dimension. It means that we observe only this 2x2 matrix, which mimics that one. However, notice that A2 and A3 are completely arbitrary. There is no constraint on it at all, because the tracelessness is achieved in this invisible sector here by choosing A4 to be minus the sum of those which we observe. So, I claim it's a trivial observation, but you know, maybe one should be aware of it. If there exists a five-dimensional gravitational wave propagating in the extra dimension, so here in our space we would observe something which would completely violate the TT property, because sum of A2 and A3 is not zero as we expect for four-dimensional gravitational waves. That's one trivial observation. So what I claim is that such a wave would be exhibited by deforming circle into an ellipse, but these amounts are not the same. It may even be positive and positive, and compensated by negative value here, for example.
You know that this is somehow connected with the number of polarization of gravitons. Mm-hmm. So in four-dimensional case, we have two polarizations, so two different states. So basically, it's either X mode or plus mode, so mm-hmm. it's a different location. So in five-dimensional case, I don't remember, as I remember, it's five different polarizations.
Well, this is this number, I think, isn't it?
I don't know, but in four-dimensional it gives you two, yes, and five-dimensional it gives you five. So it's, I remember it. So five different polarizations. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, you consider projection of this polarization in the low-dimensional space,
I claim, but again, I don't think that there exist high-dimensional gravitational waves, but I only claim, based on this sort of a rigorous analysis, that there will be an observable effect. If LIGO measures anything, and it would be different from what we expect, that is transfer traces property, then I would say, well, maybe it may be an indication of an existence of high-dimensional gravitational waves. And of course, there will be hundreds of other explanations as well. So, anyway, just an observation, nothing, you know, important. And of course, if there are vanishing eigenvalues, then there will be deformation only in one direction and not, no motion in the other, etc., etc. So I should maybe stop now, almost. But I wanted to show you, I will go only fast through this, that so far everything dealt with generic spacetimes of the type without any field equations. We did not apply field equations at all so far. So, but then we studied some field equations. So mainly we applied Einstein's equations with lambda, but generalized to any dimension. So we are conservative in some sense. So Einstein equations generalized to high dimensions. So alpha goes not from 1 to 4, but to any d. So we studied vacuum spacetimes, viscous radiation, Maxwell field aligned, etc., etc. And I will just show you vacuum or electromagnetic spacetime are of type 2 and looks like that. And there is electromagnetic field, but there is an electric part, magnetic part, and something which can be interpreted as as gyrotons in some sense. So that's in Kund.
But of course, when you discuss these gravitational polarizations or whatever, you have to impose the equations of motion, right?
No.
Because that's exactly
That's interesting. This comes down from the fact that wild tensor has vanishing contraction. You can trace this. Well, if gravitational wave is encoded in psi 4.
So what do you call gravitational wave? It's not solution of vacuum Einstein equations.
No, this is this effect. This is this component of gravitational field,
but
which is completely transverse.
Why
it's psi n.
Why it's physical fields?
Yes.
Gravitational waves is something very special.
Yeah. Locally, as an I should say abstraction or extrapolation from four dimensional gravitational waves like PP waves, Robinson-Trautmann waves, etc. I would claim that radiative field is encoded in transverse effects and is of the lowest order according to algebraic structure of the space-time.
When you say radiative fields, you mean that there is some field equation, hyperbolic one?
No, this may be related, but this study is a local study, study of geodesic deviation.
You classify it, but it's not a real wave.
It's not wave as a function of arbitrary profile, of retarded time. There may be some coupling through field equations, but now I give a heuristic approach. What I would call the effect of gravitational wave if I measure it locally. That's my approach to it.
The gravitational wave is
Type N space time. So it's type N component.
There's some very preferred direction that it goes.
But what we're speaking about gravitational waves, we say that it's a solution of Einstein equation.
Well, it's a definition.
Not any solution. Any solution which has
with special properties. But if you have
you would like
it may be not solution of Einstein equation. So it's not
gravitational
wave.
For gravitational wave you would like to solve wave equation. That's what you want to say.
Yeah, by definition physics
define
gravitational waves as a reality.
Valery, you were speaking about general gravity with some arbitrary non-local action.
It doesn't matter, but
here you have also that take any theory of gravity which you like. And the gravitational wave should be solution of this sort and of type N.
Okay, but can I have a related question? So it seems that actually is the same thing, because usually the Einstein equations, they project you to the physical polarizations of the topic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So now the question is, you have that number which you gave, and if you calculate it after substituting the equal to 5, you calculate it 5. So this is precisely what you
it
expect
fits.
from the Einstein
equations. Well, it fits, really.
Yeah, but maybe it's the same thing, actually.
There maybe is a deep connection between it, which I don't see now. But this analysis, which we did here, is nothing else than just local decomposition of accelerations into something which is coupled to algebraic types. If I go to type N, I have transverse motion encoded in symmetric traces metric. And if you trace it back, it is because while is traces. So you don't need to apply any field equations to come to this calculation. But of course, if you live in Einstein world, you have Einstein equations, and if you solve type N spacetimes, you rigorously recover this. But of course, moreover, you know what are the psi 4 components, and they are usually arbitrary functions of retard, time, u, etc. And you can prescribe it arbitrarily. That's how it really works. But this is really a local analysis, and it somehow is generally enough for me to claim that I would call this effect gravitational wave component of the gravitational field. I don't talk about propagation of waves, local effects on test particles.
Something else to say, I want to look for plane waves in any theory. You have something as sense, something what is going in one direction in a reasonable plane wave.
Again, I should say that there is this privileged spatial direction A1, because this is this longitudinal direction, and this is nothing else than the projection of the quadruply degenerate null K, which is one aligned, onto the space of this observer. So it really works that you live in a very highly algebraically special space-time in which there always exists quadruply degenerate everywhere and everywhere the same null direction aligned to wild tensor. And for a given observer, if you project it on its transfer space, you have a privileged spatial direction A1, and that's exactly this A1, which is the propagation direction, and all the motions are transfers to it.
So I will say that gravitational waves are better to look for solution in this class.
Yes.
So it may be, it may not.
Yes.
And I think you can make realization of your theory, and you obtain theory of some perturbation in flat space time. So it will be classification of these perturbations in some sense.
Yes.
So
and in general, the field is complete, and you have all components of the gravitational field. You may have type D Schwarzschild background on which you have gravitational wave, and therefore you have type 2 space time, etc. But I can locally decompose it into specific motions. One would be Coulomb-like Newton and Lundgren transfers and background given by lambda.
It's probably true that it's Newton-like, that it is really somehow falling as Coulomb law.
Yes. If you apply field equations, you will find that appropriate follow peeling. I am not talking about peeling, global effects. I am talking about local observations based on detectors, really, LIGO. This is acceleration in terms of position. And this is encoded in various components of the field, etc., etc. So that's my. Now, field equations. So let's just briefly go through it, and it will be fast. So, for example, you may have gravitational wave here encoded in the C. This is an arbitrary profile. If you solve vacuum Einstein equations, then the C must be something like Laplace on C is zero. And then you have a profile and you can prescribe the C arbitrarily. But you may have also electromagnetic field, and you may have gyroton here, encoded here and there in E, etc., etc. So type 2 space time. No, it is not here. This is Kund. And you don't have black holes in Kund. It's in Robinson-Trautmann, which is the next slide.
Uh-huh.
So if you solve Robinson-Trautmann, now vacuum. So assume vacuum Einstein equations and Robinson-Trautmann geometry in any dimension. You end up with this metric. And this is much more restricted than in four dimensions.
It's Tangerini, basically, yeah.
So basically, you see Schwarzschild because the Tangerini is encoded in this transverse metric here. Notice that these are just constant. Cosmic constant, mass of the black hole, and K can be normalized to 0 plus or minus 1 to have topological black holes, basically. So, what was surprising for us, that we really explicitly solved all vacuum Einstein equations in this Robinson-Trautmann high-dimensional family. And we expected to find something like symmetric, which is accelerating black holes or whatever. But we end up with what was already known with Schwarzschild black holes.
This is a four-dimensional case. This Robinson-Trautmann contains Kerr.
No. Kerr is twisting. Kerr has rotation twist, and we are in non-twisting family.
Okay. So
this however, one recent observation. We found a paper in which people put Kerr metric and transform it into the metric form, which is basically our ansatz. So maybe what we calculated also applies to twisting space-times, but it's not yet studied what's contained. So to be safe, I would say Kerr is neglected here because it's a non-twisting family from the very beginning.
Yeah.
So So I should say that we really solved in 2006 with Marcello Ortaggio vacuum equations in Robinsonian family. Up to the very end, we really solved all equations. That was really, even that was surprising for us. But we found that it's a very restrictive family. Then in 4D, you have more room. For example, in high dimensions, you cannot have no gravitational waves, and there is no symmetric which are accelerating black holes. It is not here in this class. We did it also for, well, here is the difference, actually. You can trace it, it boils down to these terms. There is lambda, okay. There is mass, okay. But in high dimension, this is just a constant, plus, minus one, or zero. You cannot have anything non-trivial. But in four dimensions, there is a whole space of functions, which are complicated functions of x and u, and this they encode accelerating black holes, gravitational waves, spherical one, etc. But they do not exist in high dimensions.
So, as I remember, there is a solution which Kindersley rocket, I suppose, which emit now fluid.
I will show you later. This will be the end of my talk. Photon rockets. But this is a vacuum solution. I'm talking about vacuum.
But then there were some Turkey people who...
Yeah, I will show you. It's on the next slide. So, I'm talking about vacuum. Simplest, I take Ricci equals zero, and that's it. And integrating, we recover only this very special type D or conformally flat. There is no type N, type 3, and even in type D, there are no symmetrics, etc. So it's really... So four dimensions are very nice. There is more room. More solutions, non-trivial solutions in the Robinson-Trautmann family. If you switch on, well, this is a classification of vacuum Robinson-Trautmann, and you can see that there is no type 3 and N, only type D and conformally flat in high dimensions. So that's how it is. Well, and there are no gyrotons, for example. This is a recent paper with Robert last year. We really looked for integrating vacuum field equations in Robinson-Trautmann class, keeping off-diagonal terms, like gyrotonic terms, but after a painful calculation and using identities, we found that it has no physical meaning. So there are no gyrotons in Robinson-Trautmann class. So that's how it is. Anyway, you can switch on in the class electromagnetic field, and you end up with electric field like that, which is something like Geissler-Nordström, of course. And also in even dimensions you have magnetic field. That was known. But very recently, it's a paper published in JHEC now, you know, a few months ago again, with Marcello and Martin Jovka. We generalized, we solved Robinson-Trautmann geometry with Maxwell field, but the Maxwell field is any P form, it's not a 2 form. So it's basically a generalization of this previous side when there is electric and magnetic field. So of course, if you take P equals 2, if you have 2 forms, like in standard Maxwell's theory, then this reduces to previous results. And of course, electric field is encoded in this form and magnetic field in this form. But interestingly enough, we found that for a very special choice, when we are in dimension which is even, but bigger than D, so it must be at least 6, and then 8, etc. And if the form is just half of the dimension, so we have a 3 form in 6 dimensional space-time, there is more room, and there exists not only type D, but also type 2 black holes, with gravitational waves in this sense, and there is electromagnetic radiation, which is of type 2, or even N. So really, it's encoded in this additional electromagnetic field. And see, here is arbitrary function of the retarded time u, which solves the equations, Einstein-Maxwell equations. And this is really an electromagnetic wave. And it's accompanied by corresponding component in the gravitational field. So interestingly enough, if you go from Maxwell 2-form field to 3-form field in 6 dimensions, you will recover that there are not only type D, static black holes, but also this non-static black holes with electromagnetic radiation, which is of type N. Which was quite surprising for us. So really, vacuum field equations play an important role, what really can happen or not. And there are real surprises, even recent ones. Now, to your last question, pure radiation space-times. So again, Robinson-Trautmann class, and we solve it for this matter, aligned to photon field, for example. So here is the metric. Well, maybe let's show it here. This is a Robinson Tautman metric. There is mass, cosmological constant, and there is a function p. But the function p is at most quadratic in this transverse coordinates. Maybe I should show you here. It's maybe better here. But interestingly enough, these coefficients encode the velocity of an observer, which is moving in that spacetime. So the whole structure of this family of spacetimes in any dimension with lambda is such that you have some trajectory. You prescribe any trajectory of your source, and you take its for velocity. So components of this vector u are combined here, and you really generate the function p. And then you take this p into the metric, and you have an exact solution of pure field radiation.
You know, the funny story was that Mills and Andrei showed the solution of this. And when we were preparing paper, we find out that
this was novel in higher. Yeah. So here are some references. So you talk about these works.
Right, yeah.
So they did it really parallel to what you did. And you are mentioned here also because you were one of the first who studied this Skinner's class of spacetimes in four dimensions before Bonner, 20 years after that, nicknamed them photon rockets, because actually this is a science fiction. This really describes the exact solution for a photon rocket. Because you really have a rocket or an object of mass, but the mass is decreasing and it's radiated in the form of anisotropic radiation of photons. And due to the Beck reaction, the photon, the rocket somehow moves along arbitrarily prescribed trajectory right here. So this is really a funny story that such a simple metric describes a complete gravitational field of an arbitrarily maneuvering photon rocket. You only need to collimate your photons in one direction and then you are pushed on the opposite direction. So that's...
No, that is a very interesting physical question. So you can control, you have control function m of u. So it's matter how you burn your rocket. But
yeah, that's basically this equation here. This is a radiation radiation field and there is a decrease of mass.
Now the question, the interesting question. So it's possible to have a flat space-time such lines. It's not geodesic and not uniformly phased, but particles which are moving arbitrary growing acceleration, which reach infinity of space and finite time. So
it has really big acceleration.
It's growing acceleration. It's not constant. Constant take infinity it's a growing acceleration. In principle, it's
so maybe hidden in this metric, isn't it?
Sometimes. So the question is that in this case, you have m of u. Is it possible to have such a function?
I don't know. Let's study it. I mean, this is the simplest subcase when the acceleration is such that u only accelerates in one direction.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's the metric in any dimension. You see, this is this transverse space. And this alpha of u is an acceleration as a function of u.
Yes.
So usually people took alpha to be a constant acceleration in one direction.
Yeah.
But you say that if you prescribe alpha of u to be growing function, then you can reach infinity in some sense in a finite time.
You find a proper time.
It well may be. I studied some properties of it, like what would be the radiation pattern, this is plotted here, or would be the decrease of mass, which would be exponential. And what would be the final mass as a function of final velocity? So you can really measure the energetic somehow balance of how it would work. But I did not study your idea. What would be the proper time to reach infinity?
It may be that.
But it could be hidden in this metric somehow.
It may be for this particular case it will be always infinite because it's self-consistent, but.
You can prescribe any alpha of u and it would still work because you just put it here and you have really very big decrease of mass, exponentially decreasing mass, but if alpha is really exponentially decreasing, then that will be exponentially decreasing mass. So you can arrange for it, I think. Well, let's inspect it. This is a nice idea. I like it. But I played a little bit more game. I said, well, let's examine, what will happen, if you have a star and you want to investigate it. You can approach it and decelerate again. Yeah? And then accelerate again back to the Earth. But what about doing something different? You have a star and you will make a U-turn, which is forbidden on highways, isn't it? So let's take a star and let's do a U-turn. With constant velocity, you will only change the direction of the velocity. This is, you just describe your maneuver. This is simple. You just say cosine and sine of U. A is the radius of the circle around the star with constant angular velocity. So you prescribe your trajectory. So you prescribe your trajectory, you put it here, and you have an exact solution of it. So let's study it, and that's fun, really. So when you do it, you obtain this metric, well, okay, for this special function p, and I calculated the radiation pattern. So that, what should be the photon's like radiation pattern to achieve the U-turn? And that looks like that. So, of course, it's asymmetric now. So the rocket approaches here and makes a U-turn and going back with the same velocity around the star. But the radiation pattern must be such that more photons are radiated, the most photons are radiated somewhere ahead to the right, and then you are somehow deflected to the left. And of course, because the mass is exponentially decreasing, there is exponentially decrease of the amount of radiation. So these patterns are smaller and smaller schematically. So I played with it a little bit and it's quite a fun. And I even calculated what would be the decrease of mass and what would be the proper mass after the U-turn. And I compare it. So this graph shows what would be the maneuver, you know, reaching a star directly, decelerating and then accelerating backwards to the same velocity, or with the velocity make a U-turn.
You know, there is a cheaper way, just go use the gravitational field of the star. You can radiate nothing and go around.
Absolutely, you are absolutely right, but I'm afraid that there should be a super massive black hole to deflect you if you are moving with velocity of light almost.
We discussed this on page after this interstellar movie. Can find solution of the following problem. What is the cheapest way how to use a rocket to come to the innermost stable orbit and return back? Mm-hmm. So what is the trajectory which take less of your fuel?
Anyway, so if I treat this only as a test point, small star, then the graphs are almost the same, you see, so it was not easy to distinguish what is better, but this is less efficient. So the best way is to really head-on approach your star, decelerate to zero, investigate it there for 2 months, and then go backwards. This is more efficient. And it applies to any dimension, and even with cosmological constants. So this is, you know, what I give to future generations of explorers, you know, do it like that. Anyway, of course, this is a highly special space-time because it's of type D. I don't claim that it can be applied in practice. Moreover, this is not a rocket. This is a singularity and it has open horizon, etc. But as a test model, it's fun. And that's all. So, you know, what I did, algebraic classification of space-times, or a general class of Robinson-Topman and Kundt that is non-twisting CFE geometries, algebraic structure, etc. And of course, special cases are Kundt class, applying field equations, etc. Or Robinson-Trautmann, again, applying field equations. And this is more restrictive. So that's all, and I think, more than 20 minutes after. But there was already discussion during it, so maybe you will forgive me for.
Okay, my last thank you, speaker. More questions?
Forgetting the second part of the talk, this part on gravitational waves.
On gravitational, this local gravitational geodesic deviation.
But do you think that can be also application to cosmology or cosmological
measure? No, good question. I don't know. Let me think of it. So let's come back to this decomposition of the gravitational field. Mm-hmm. Well, this works in any dimension for any field. And in this work, I mean, this FISREV paper 2012, you really find that we started with a very general ansatz, not talking about Kundt class or whatever. Just assume that we have field equations and decompose wild tensor into the components. And then you really have some components like that. And the point is, cosmology. What's your model of your universe? Of course, if we use the Friedman universe, they are conformally flat. So everything will be zero except for cosmological constant, basically. So there would be exponential expansion, which would be in the Sitter space, which you already observed, and it will be isotropic.
So there will be no deformation or change from the higher dimension.
If the cosmological constant is universal for all dimensions, if it's a common lambda for all sectors of all spatial directions, then that should be isotropic. So again, the point is, this is the equation of geodesic deviation. I think that's the very definition. Actually, one should bear in mind that this is an approximation, because you don't take into account higher order contribution. This is just a linearization of the local effects of acceleration. And moreover, initially your particles, which you somehow compare, must be parallel. So they cannot move with ultra-relativistic speeds one with respect to the other. So this form of equation of geodesic deviation is such that really these initial geodesics are such that they are almost parallel. They do not move with proper velocities big enough. And therefore, you can neglect some higher order terms. So this is one restriction. And it's, of course, a local analysis, because how you obtain equation of geodesic deviation? Actually, this was first obtained by Levi-Civita in the 20s, and then Singer wrote about it in the 50s, if you trace back the equation of geodesic deviation. It's a linearized effect of gravitational field on local acceleration. So I'm afraid that if you go to cosmological distances, that these assumptions would be valid. So I would be skeptical about application on the global cosmology. But if we live in a very special space-time, which is really conformally flat everywhere, it means that all these scalars vanish and we are left only with isotropic motions, and then it's really a global effect. And if you really go to Levi-Civita and Singer, they really studied the Sitter and anti-de Sitter, and they have explicit solution of equation of geodesic deviation, and this is exact. So again, what is the model of our universe? I really do not know. But it doesn't matter what is the dimension. It would just, you know, somehow rescale your dark energy, if you want. So, but
this higher dimension allow you a higher variety of possible gravitational waves. If you have more type of gravitational waves, more deformation, this polarization.
Yeah. But I'm talking about a conformally flat universe like Friedman. So this I'm not sure. Really, we studied locally, and in particular, we wanted to study this local effect on gravitational wave detectors. Same, maybe.
In the cosmological
concept.
In the background, in the cosmology.
Yeah, it is a. Well, yes. Of course, typically, well, there are exact solutions in the Kund and Robinson-Tautman class, which are of type N. So they have this transverse effect, which I described here, like this. And they are vacuum, but they emit cosmological constant. So you can find them, you know, I can give you references. So there are exact solutions to Einstein equations, which are vacuum with lambda of any value, and they are of type N. And there you really can describe arbitrary profile of your wave. You can even may have a sandwich wave, you may have an impulsive wave, and whatever. So you may easily construct impulsive waves, just one wave surface propagating in de Sitter spacetime, for example, or anti-de Sitter spacetime. So that will be spherical waves propagating, or either expanding or non-expanding, depending on Kund or Robinson-Tautman class. So we have about 20 papers on impulsive waves on cosmological backgrounds. And by backgrounds, I mean the Sitter on anti-Sitter backgrounds. So then I can give you some references if you want to do this. But again, we may have gravitational waves, exact gravitational waves encoded in this trifold on these isotropic backgrounds described by lambda that exists. So that would be like having tidal deformations on an exponentially expanding the Sitter universe. Yeah, so all these ellipses would be expanding in addition to what they do here, because they will be also expanding with the density background. Okay, so I don't know if I answered your question. We can discuss maybe later if you want. So I don't know about application to cosmology. That would be really be. I'm afraid that the application of the geodetic deviation would not be valid in this context. But I'm not sure.
Okay, let us thank the speaker again.